simply don't believe that because the documentation is not explicit, that means that those permits are invalid.
The state fights the federal government over coal permits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a chase on the Glen Highway ends in a shooting death.
The car continued down the road south towards Anchorage and eventually made its way to Glen Highway. And about mile 25, the vehicle caught on fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The State Department of Natural Resources is backing the validity of permits issued to Usabelli Coal for its Wishbone Hill project. The state is taking a strong stand against the Federal Office of Surface Management while upholding the primacy of Alaska over its coal mining program and permitting decisions. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The dispute over the Wishbone Hill coal permits has been going on for months. Residents near the proposed coal mine near Sutton in the Matanuska Valley have filed complaints against the project with both state and federal authorities, citing health and pollution concerns. Opponents of the coal mine also have called into question the validity of the Usabelli permits. Last month, the Federal Office of Surface Management, which monitors coal mining, sent a letter to the State Department of Natural Resources, Mining, Land, and Water Division, giving DNR a 10-day notice in which to provide documentary proof of the validity of the permits. Today, the state made public its response. DNR Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles.
We have provided them the information that we believe shows that the permits are still valid, and we are upholding the validity of those permits. We have also determined that the permits need additional baseline information to fill some gaps, and we have directed Usabelli not to do any work on site until those gaps are filled.
At issue is how extensions of time to begin actual mining must be documented in the permit file. The original permits were issued in 1991 and have been transferred and granted extensions for their use in a series of actions since then. DNR has sent OSM a 24-page letter outlining the permit's history in minute detail.
There's a provision in the coal regulations that requires that we grant the permittee an extension of time to mine, and so the argument is about how that was documented. And while we don't have clear documentation for that extension and some of those renewals, we just simply don't believe that because the documentation is not explicit, that means that those permits are invalid.
DNR contends the greater issue is the intrusion of OSM into the state's permitting process and the use of the 10-day notice procedure to do so. Fogles says OSM's actions could have troubling consequences.
For the business climate in Alaska, if a company is to invest in either, whether it's a mine or an oil and gas project or any other kind of project, you know, they need some kind of certainty that once we issue them their permits that we're not going to come back in many years later and invalidate them.
Usabelli spokeswoman Lorelei Carter applauded the state's actions, saying Friday's letter cautions OSM
to stop their extreme overreach into the state's program.
Carter says OSM has inspected the mine site on many occasions and has issued favorable reports related to Wishbone Hill. Carter says OSM's action
undermines the entire concept of a reliable permit.
Although Usabelli has postponed plans for coal exploration there for the time being, Carter says the company intends to continue mining operations in the future at Wishbone Hill. Both the state and Usabelli must now await OSM's response. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
An early morning shooting involving an Alaska state trooper left one man dead and shut down the Glen Highway for hours this morning. According to trooper spokeswoman Beth Ibsen, the action began in Wasilla around 4 a.m. when a traffic violation was spotted by a trooper.
It was a 94 Saturn coupe The vehicle did a series of right-hand turns, and so the trooper initiated a traffic stop, and the vehicle failed to yield, and a pursuit ensued. But the car continued down the road south towards Anchorage and eventually made its way to Glen Highway. And about mile 25, the vehicle caught on fire.
Spike strips placed near the Glen turnoff punctured one of the car's tires. The male driver left the vehicle and ran into the northbound lane.
They tried unsuccessfully to subdue him, and they tried, you know, even using a taser. And during this altercation, the man came at three troopers with a bat, and that's when one of the troopers shot him, and the man was pronounced deceased on scene.
The man was pronounced dead around 4:20 a.m. No troopers were injured in the incident. Wasilla and Anchorage police assisted in the case. The name of the trooper in the shooting is being withheld for 72 hours in accordance with trooper policy. The name of the victim has not yet been released. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation has assumed responsibility for the case. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School District releases a new plan for student achievement.
We will attend every child that comes into this system in a way that will allow them to start to grow.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This week, Anchorage School District Superintendent Jim Browder released the latest student test scores and introduced a multi-year district-wide plan to boost them. Scores over the last 5 years show overall achievement remains relatively flat. Browder says the new plan will focus on strengthening the basics.
Reading, writing, math, attendance, and graduation rates. And what we've done is we've looked at our reading series where looking at adopting a new K-8 math series, and it's our hope that through aligning our curriculum with the Common Core and assuring that in kindergarten, these are the set of things that kindergartners need to know to be successful at the second grade, which allows them through the 12th grade to be successful, which means when they come out of the chute, they are ready to either be college students, go to work, or do career technical. They are post-secondary ready at that point.
How is that going to be a change from what's happening currently? I think there's an expectation by parents in the community that children are being prepared in these grades for moving up and going on to higher education. What's going to change?
What's going to change in my mind is the focus. The focus is going to go to the Common Core, which the board adopted in the spring. They're more rigorous standards. So what we were doing last year in the fourth grade, we're probably doing in the second or third grade now.
Mr. Browder, the test scores that just came out, writing, math, and science edged up less than a percentage point. Reading
right.
Scores jumped about 2%. What is the standards-based assessment, the tests that the scores come from, and what do those scores tell us about where Anchorage students are currently?
Well, the scores are about the standards, the state standards, that children should be learning in order to be successful. What we're changing to are more rigorous standards that our children will have to understand and be able to perform in order to be successful at the next grade level.
How will you work to meet the challenges of such a diverse student population in Anchorage? More than half the students are minorities. Many are immigrants from other countries. English is a second language. Plus, we're having migration of more and more Alaska Native students from rural villages to the Anchorage School District.
There isn't an issue in my mind with Give us the children we're going to have, and let us start the work. We will attend every child that comes into this system in a way that will allow them to start to grow. The challenge is not by culture, by race. By the challenge is to get the system to understand that here's the plan and we got to execute it with every kid.
Anchorage School Superintendent Jim Browder. Scientists tracking marine mammals in the Chukchi Sea report a record number of gray whale calves in July. The Federal Alaska Fisheries Science Center says 57 cow and calf pairs were recorded. The Eastern Pacific North Pacific population of gray whales is estimated between 18,000 and 21,000. The animals make seasonal trips from the Chukchi Sea to Mexico. All the cow-calf pairs were found within 30 nautical miles of the Alaska coast between Barrow and Point Lay. The state's first ever review of community development quota groups, or CDQs, is underway. The CDQ groups were created in 1992 to bring impoverished Western Alaska communities into the lucrative Bering Sea fisheries. Today, the six nonprofit corporations split roughly 10% of various fish quotas and collectively own more than $700 million in assets. The state's review is supposed to increase accountability, but as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it might be just a dry run.
For the CDQ groups, the review is familiar territory. The state is asking them to evaluate their own financial performance and the jobs and educational opportunities they provided to their member villages. They'll have to determine whether they've met goals they outlined in their own individual community development plans. Larry Cotter is the executive director of the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, or APICTA. He says most groups have been reviewing themselves in these categories for years. The difference is that now, a part of each group's share of the Bering Sea fisheries quotas is at stake. But Cotter says he's not too concerned.
Every group has done well. Now, we're not to be measured against each other. We're to be measured against ourselves. I think the likelihood of any reallocation is not very significant. It may happen, but I don't expect it to happen.
When Congress amended the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 2006, they created the 10-year review. They wanted it to have teeth. The idea was to punish CDQs that weren't bringing wealth back to their member communities. They would lose part of their quota, and it would be distributed to the other groups. But it's not clear if the state will have enough information to determine whether a CDQ group is underperforming. That's because this decennial review can only include 4 years of data. The review period didn't start until 2006, when the review was first written into law. So instead of a full decade, the state can only examine the group's performance from 2006 to 2010. APICTA's Cotter says he thinks that will limit the state's ability to draw any useful conclusions about the group's work.
I don't think you can start in 2006. I think you really need to take a look at the year 2000 and how we've really done in the past decade.
The Department of Commerce is the state agency in charge of the review. They've also been struggling with its limitations. Deputy Commissioner Curtis Thayer says most of the state's energy has gone into writing a rule book that defines the state's role in the CDQ review process. Congress left it to the state to figure out how to conduct the review and judge the CDQ groups. Carving out rules and deadlines has left the state with very little time to consider how the review will influence the quota. Here's Thayer.
The state is confining our process to determine if the CDQ entity has maintained or improved its overall performance with respect to the criteria and or has not maintained or improved. The state will not make any adjustments to the allocations.
The review panel consists of one representative each from the Departments of Commerce, Labor, and Fish and Game. If they agree that a CDQ group is underperforming, they alone can't change the quota. They would have to ask the National Marine Fisheries Service to step in. If NMFS agreed with the panel, they could remove up to 10% of that group's quota allocation. Congress could weigh in on the requirement for a review next year when the entire Magnuson-Stevens Act is up for reauthorization. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The G-String Orchestra is comprised of four young musicians wearing tight jeans and sporting black tattoos covering their arms, necks, hands, and some of their faces. They first started playing as a band when they met in Homer 3 summers ago, and they perform music that an audience may not expect to hear, Eastern European gypsy music. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
On a rainy morning in Anchorage, several travelers start packing up their sleeping bags in a living room in Anchorage. As a young woman with short bleached hair, Sarah Jacques warms up her accordion. The other members of her band step over the dogs that are running around the living room, tuning their own instruments, a banjo, a fiddle, and a stand-up bass. Together they are the G-String Orchestra, a band that Ian Cook, the fiddle player, says focuses on klezmer and gypsy-style music.
Traditionally, klezmer music is old Jewish music for anything from funerals to weddings to bar mitzvahs to any excuse to party. Same thing with all the other tunes. And we also write originals in the same vein, keeping with the tradition of the traveling music. And we travel as well as does the music.
And everyone in the band certainly fits the description of travelers. They spend some time in New Orleans, some time in Homer, and the rest of the time they are scattered across the country. Cook says that the traveling spirit is an important element in their music.
A lot of these tunes that we play, the traditional tunes, have started in one region of the world and through their travel have adopted other sounds from the local regions that they travel through. And all of a sudden they end up and we're playing some of these songs that may have originated in Bulgaria or Russia or Romania, and we're playing them in Alaska.
And the band welcomes opportunities to play with local musicians wherever they are. Cook says they pick up styles or elements from different regions that influence their songs.
People that come through, have a banjo or a fiddle or a washboard, and sometimes we'll sit and trade tunes and play together.
They first played together as a band 3 summers ago when Cook says he met their stand-up bass player randomly at a house in Homer. They started playing at Main Street, which is now Homer Hounds. The bass player, David Young, says he knew he would love playing in the G-string orchestra immediately.
People talk about true love or love at first sight or all these things, and sometimes you just approach something or it approaches you and you just know that it works for you and that you will really enjoy it.
Young says that he and the other band members are well received in Alaska and always enjoy touring the state.
People just have misconceptions about, what Alaska can be like and what the people up here, and that people do have really great appreciation for many different things, and folk music included.
So what are some of the other things that people don't know about Alaska?
The beer. No, I'm kidding.
The G-String Orchestra plays at the Taproot this Saturday. Then they move down to Hope on Sunday. They will be touring around Alaska for the remainder of the summer in a station wagon and what they call mixed transportation methods. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Daisha Eaton. This week on AK, beer. It's no secret that Alaskans love their beer. And in Anchorage, it's showing now more than ever. Established local breweries are constantly expanding, and new smaller operations are always popping up. David Waldron recently tracked the adventure of one such brewery.
Just last year, 2 new breweries opened in Anchorage. With seemingly no end to these startups, I decided to find out why brewing Alaskan beer is so appealing. So I began at the beginning.
Over here is all the kettles. You need something to brew in, and these are things that you would brew in. All made out of stainless steel. Plenty of good steel.
This is Andrew Leonard Fried Schmidt. He works at Arctic Brewing Supply here in Anchorage. The company has been selling home brewing supplies for more than 25 years, so it's not hard to imagine that some of our local brewers have spent time in here during their careers. In mere minutes, Andrew shows me how easy it is to start my own brewing operation.
You can get started and make your very first batch of beer with any of the things you see here. There's only 4 ingredients in beer, and we sell 3 of them. The other one comes out of your faucet.
And if that doesn't sound simple enough, they make it even easier.
All of them come with one of our beer in a can. It's the Campbell Soup method. All you have to do is really add this to a pot of boiling water, cool it down, add it to some cold water, and pitch the yeast that comes right in there. 2 to 4 weeks later, you've got yourself a delicious beer.
And once you get comfortable making these Campbell's Soup beers, the list of recipes Arctic Brewing Supply sells is vast.
There's the Anchorage Steam Beer, which is a replication of Anchor Steam. The borrowed from Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, or the Bush Rat Amber.
But really, it seems like the best part about home brewing is creating your own recipes. You can pick out your own hops.
You want to stick your head in there and smell it.
Your own kegs.
These are old soda kegs. And they're great kegs. As you can see, they still hold pressure.
And even your own labels.
Any kind of label you can see of. Barrels, flowers, clocks.
Not being ready to start my own brewing company just yet, I paid a visit to one of Anchorage's newest kids on the block, the King Street Brewing Company.
You guys are welcome to taste some stuff.
Yeah,
I would like to try a block IPA.
I'm gonna use that.
Okay.
The place was small but inviting. The smell of malt and hops were thick, and they instantly made me thirsty. But first things first, let's meet the owners.
We had the kind of crazy idea that we'd kind of run this on the weekends. And so we kind of set it up to run with just one person. But quickly, within months, we found that we were outpacing, demand was outpacing what we could produce.
And then last week, we got a chuckling, and we're like, Dana, wait, we got a birthday coming up here pretty quick. So
that's co-owner Shane Kingry, and the birthday he's referring to is the one-year anniversary of King Street Brewing Company, which will be coming up this month. Dana Walukowicz is the other co-owner and says both he and Shane started out like many other successful brewers from their home.
You know, really, the science is the same as in home brewing. They're basically using the same ingredients we are. We're just doing it about 31 times the size of batches.
We take our malt, which is 600 or 700 pounds. We drop it through the chute over here.
After looking over the operational side of things, we talk beer. It's clear from the start how much these guys love making it.
It's one part science. It's one part art and one part mystery too, and it's almost like, you know, in some aspects it's like baking, and you know, you get to enjoy something that you've put together that perhaps no one else has created before.
As to why Alaskans love their local beer so much, Shane echoes the theme of freshness.
It's like fresh fruit, you know, but we used to get, well, we still don't get the best stuff here, but you know, you go to Hawaii and you love the fresh fruit.
Of course, freshness can't be the only reason we love local beer.
We've got good water, which helps to make good beer. We've got a lot of very passionate producers and brewers of that beer. And like anything else, I think Alaskans are, they're big, you know. And so, I mean, if we have an interest, let's make it a big interest.
And these guys back up their go big talk. On top of running the brewery, both Shane and Dana have full-time day jobs elsewhere. The amount of work to keep this place running seems exhausting.
You know, I mean, there's certain things, if I need to do repairs, I can't do them when they're brewing, so I got to come in at night when they're done, you know, and get home, and my wife is like, oh, who are you?
And though the workload can put a strain on their families at times, the guys at King Street consider many of their customers like family, or at least close friends. Jerry is paying a visit to the taproom today, and he is one of them. Jerry works for a different company on King Street, and although he says the location is convenient, in the end, he comes for the quality.
I've been, you know, very impressed with the quality here right from the very beginning. It's been exceptional.
Time to finally find out for myself. We end our adventure at the most appropriate place, the bar.
Cheers. Cheers, yeah.
This is a mighty fine Pilsner. And if Andrew over at Arctic Brewing Supply is right, we can expect more breweries like this popping up in the future.
I don't think that there will be any end in sight in startup Alaskan breweries. You can never have too much beer.
For AK, I'm Dave Waldron.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're visiting Halibut Cove, a community located just a short water taxi ride across Kachemak Bay from Homer.
My name is Clem Tillian. I live in Halibut Cove, and I'm kind of the grandfather here. We're a community of about 112 people, of which only about 30 stay year-round. It's become more of a summer resort than a fishing community now. It's a beautiful little place in the fjords. It's two islands in the mouth of Halibut Cove that make a harbor behind them, and a lagoon in the back that produces quite a bit of fish. It was a ghost town when I came. They weren't families here. It was Scandinavian fishermen and Scots girls that came to pack the Scotch cured herring for the world market. And when they pretty well wiped out the herring fishery by dumping the cuttings right back in the spawning ground, that collapsed in 1928. So when I came, we were the first family that had children. And we just started offering land to artists that wanted a summer home if they would. And some of them came and just lived here. Alex Combs, that has quite a bit of work around Anchorage, was a professor of art for the university. And I gave him a lot, a little over an acre, on the agreement that he'd teach the kids pottery for the next 3 years. He taught for 30, you know. It was one of the best buys I ever made. There's 17 or 18 artists here. They're all doing rather well. There's two art galleries. My son-in-law and daughter have the Saltry restaurant. Wintertime, the mail comes on the Stormbird twice a week. I often say, come hell or high water. My wife said frequently with both. And so the place is alive all winter. It's beautiful. You know, the only place that's prettier is Sitka, Alaska.
Clem Tillion is one of the founders of Halibut Cove. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Fight. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. Daisha Eaton was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
And by
Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.